From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, striking criticism of the Obama administration's Syria policy from within the U.S. State Department. 51 U.S. diplomats sent a letter through the department's dissent channel calling for U.S. military action in Syria, strikes targeting the forces of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They said American officials' efforts to deal with the conflict have been overwhelmed, that the Obama foreign policy is facing dire, if not disastrous, humanitarian, diplomatic, and terror challenges. They want more military muscle applied. This hour on Point, the State Department's dissent challenge to President Obama on Syria. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Would you pull the trigger on U.S. strikes against Assad? Is there a deeper rebuke here of Obama foreign policy, the Obama doctrine? Are you glad he's stayed out? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me first today from Monterey, California, is Margaret Brennan. She covers the State Department and Foreign Affairs for CBS News. Margaret, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be here.
So Vice President Biden out today saying, hey, wait a minute, we've thought about all this, criticizing this channel, this dissent cable, saying they don't have an answer in here. Do we have a full-on standoff now between the State Department and the White House? John Kerry hasn't condemned it, but the Vice President is now more or less doing just that.
No, John Kerry said just yesterday, it's a great cable, and I plan to meet with the, with its authors. But you're right. Vice President Biden told my colleague Charlie Rose that basically, though he first said he couldn't comment on what is a classified cable, he then went on to dismantle what he called, common criticism that they often hear from critics of the administration itself, and saying, we've thought about all of this, but while we recognize that our own strategy, which is to pursue the cessation of hostilities, is not working. In fact, Biden said he's not optimistic about its outcome. Basically, they're just managing a bad situation. And that was how he described what the White House's thoughts are about what to do next in Syria, saying we don't have an answer as to what happens if Assad goes, and we don't have Congress's support for us to do anything more at this time. So he didn't really go into all the very thought-out arguments made by some of these diplomats, but he shut it down, saying, listen, we're happy with where we are, and it's a bad situation. We know that, but that's what we're going to be managing through the last 6 or 7 months of this administration.
Which in some ways seemed exactly what this cable was protesting, not explicitly, but like, let's stop rope-a-doping here. There's a real issue, the cable said. Here was Vice President Biden. This was with Charlie Rose on CBS this morning. Here's a little bit of that.
The president and I and previous presidents support the right of any diplomat to have a secure channel to voice a different view. But there's not a single solitary recommendation that I saw that is a single solitary answer attached to it, how to do what they're talking about.
Joe Biden, the vice president this morning, going after the cable signed by 51 mid-level State Department officials, leaked last week in the New York Times. Margaret Brennan with CBS is with us. Give us the backstory as you understand it here. I mean, the dissatisfaction with the state of affairs in Syria has been well known for some time. This work on a ceasefire and an agreement within it has looked kind of preposterously ineffective for some time. What brought this out last week, Margaret?
Well, it's also interesting. The vice president said, you know, this cable dissent didn't provide any answers, just sort of raised more questions. And it wasn't meant to prescribe a policy. It was criticizing the existing one and saying, yeah, look, we need to revisit what we're doing here. What the Obama administration's stated point is that they want to get to a negotiated political settlement in Syria, peace talks, which is arguably what everyone wants to get to. But what the diplomats argued in this dissent cable is, look, you can't achieve what you're saying you want to achieve because Assad's just defying all these calls for peace talks. He's not listening to the UN demands for delivery of food and medicines to starving people. He's continuing to bomb civilians, and he's continuing with his Russian forces who are backing him to bomb U.S.-backed rebels. So clearly that's not working. Let's try to change his calculus, is what these diplomats argued. And to change his calculus, you need to force him. You need to create some leverage. And right now, the U.S. doesn't really have any. So this dissent cable was saying, look, you need to apply pressure. the media
military
coverage.
Pressure, specifically military strikes from offshore.
Exactly. That was one of the proposals in there. The focus in the media has largely been on military action writ large. But these diplomats are arguing you need to really focus on the artillery. You need to focus on his air pressure because he's continuing to barrel bomb and continuing to attack civilians. Show him that he needs to get to the negotiating table. So it wasn't an argument for an invasion. It wasn't an argument for large-scale military action. But at this point, it appears the administration is really drawing a hard line here and saying military action of any sort we are opposed to beyond the 300 special operators that we have in Syria who are focusing on training and helping to take out ISIS leaders.
But this cable was pretty tough. I mean, for even a dissent channel cable saying the status quo in Syria will continue to present increasingly dire, if not disastrous, humanitarian, diplomatic, and terrorism-related challenges, saying that what they want there, a more militarily assertive U.S. role in Syria based on the judicious use of standoff and air weapons, which would undergird and drive a more focused and hard-nosed U.S.-led diplomatic process. I mean, is there a broader critique in here of Obama foreign policy saying, you know, certainly in Syria, it's just not working, and you're not stepping up to acknowledge that?
Well, what I think is extraordinary about this is that it was written by, as you say, mid-level diplomats. These are people who are, young parents with young kids starting out or mid-level career. These are not people in a position of power who have some security. These are people who made an argument because they strongly believe and made it an argument on U.S. national interests, the interests of our allies, and moral grounds that the U.S. needs to do something. So this wasn't something that was politically minded either. These are professional diplomats. They have to work for the Republicans and Democrats and certainly the next president, whoever he or she is. So the motivations behind this, I think, are really interesting to look at. And as you say, you know, what's also interesting here is the number of diplomats. This was 51. You look at past dissent cables, you look at what happened in Bosnia, say, mm-hmm. under the Clinton administration when there were calls for action, you had a dozen dissent signatories. This tells you the level, the deepness of the rift in the administration about this. So it's also interesting that you have a call for a force coming from the people whose job it is to really avoid using force, the diplomats who are always arguing to try to get to a negotiating table. And they're saying you can't get to peace talks without forcing Assad to change his calculus, because right now Assad's betting that he can win, and he is winning.
This was leaked. Are their careers actually being put on the line when they sign on to a cable like this, Margaret?
Look, I mean, the rules are that there can't be retribution against those who sign on to a classified dissent memo when it goes through the proper channels as these diplomats went through. That's the policy, and it's meant to encourage people to speak their minds here. It was created in the 70s. You know, it's been used in the
Vietnam War era. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been used to protest or to say we have, you know, strong misgivings about where policy is right now. Bosnia is the classic example because of the concern about ethnic cleansing there. But look, it takes a lot of guts in many ways to put your name out there in a classified setting to tell your, not just your direct
boss. Your Uber boss, your super boss.
Exactly, your boss's boss that what we're doing is wrong. And so that takes some confidence that putting pen to paper and your name with it isn't going to get you in trouble.
They may be mid-level, but their boss is not mid-level, Secretary of State John Kerry. And this was his response in Copenhagen on Friday. It's short, but it's anything but a slapdown of his own crew here.
I think it's an important statement, and I respect the process very, very much. And I will probably meet with people or have a chance to talk when we get back.
Do we have a significant rift here that the public is just coming to understand, to see, Margaret?
Yes. I mean, in private, a number of U.S. officials have differed with some of the other national security officials within the Obama administration and the president himself about resistance to any sort of military pressure. Secretary of State John Kerry has argued in private sessions, though he publicly does continue to support this policy and does continue to sort of doggedly chase this hope for a cessation of hostilities that the administration itself says isn't working. He privately has argued, look, I'm playing a really weak hand here. How do I get Assad? How do I get his Iranian backers? How do I get the Russians, who are now acting as Syria's air force, to agree to talk themselves out of power, or at a minimum, talk themselves into a stalemate here? And the administration's argument has been, look, this isn't in your long-term interest, Russia, to pour money into Syria. Look, this isn't in your long-term interest to get militarily involved in a country where there's going to continue to be a civil war even after ISIS is taken out, if the U.S. achieves its aim on that front. So they're trying to argue logically a situation where strategically Iran sees no reason to give up its, you know, land bridge through to Lebanon and Israel with its support force of Hezbollah, where Russia wants to continue to have its footprint militarily through its bases. So there are concrete things that Iran and Russia wants out of this, and concrete things that Assad wants out of this. And at this point, getting them to agree to do the right thing just isn't something that they've seen get to any payoff so far in many, many months of diplomatic pressure and negotiations, an attempt to broker a cessation of hostilities.
But now you have, from within the U.S. State Department, 51 signing this, talking about dire, if not disastrous, humanitarian, diplomatic, and terror challenges emerging from the Obama administration's policy here. It sounds political, but these are not political people by definition, by any means. We're going to dig on in here to what's driving this split, this rift, the significance of it, whether it may change policy in this administration or the next. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. The sound there are bombs launched by the Assad government hitting Daraa, a suburb of Damascus, in early June. Town held by Syrian rebels, cut off from the outside, prevented food and from reaching the city's starving residents there. We are talking this hour about the story of the 51 State Department officials who came out last week for U.S. military action to pressure Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Looking at the dissent channel on Obama, Syria policy, foreign policy, the call for more teeth. Margaret Brennan is with us, CBS News correspondent, covering the State Department today out of California. You can join us as well. What do you think? Is this President Obama's own State Department saying he's too weak, too reluctant to use American muscle here? And is strength here in hitting or resisting the urge to hit? Earlier this month, Assad spoke to the Syrian parliament. This may have been part of what provoked the State Department people to come forward. Here he was promising to retake all territory from his opponents, interpreted by CCTV. This indicated no going to the negotiating table, but on we go.
The bloodshed will not end until we rip out terrorism from its roots, wherever it exists, and whatever masks they put for it. And as we liberate Palmyra and other cities, we will liberate each inch of Syria from their hands, and we have no choice but to be victorious. Otherwise, there will be no Syria, and we will have no present or future for our children.
That the interpreter there by CCTV, John Kerry, has said we've got to talk. But there was a moment in Vienna last month where he said, well, our guest coming up in a few minutes, David Sanger, asked if negotiations in Syria were made more difficult because Assad didn't believe the U.S. was willing to go to a Plan B strategy, more coercive, maybe even military, in Syria. Here's Kerry's response.
If President Assad has come, if you know that he's come to a conclusion there's no Plan B, then he's come to a conclusion that is totally without any foundation whatsoever and even dangerous. Dangerous.
John Kerry indicating there is a plan B, a military, maybe a military action. But here was Joe Biden today on CBS This Morning talking with Charlie Rose. He said that they've asked and asked at the White House, and there's been no response that this would work.
The president's been fastidious. Calls the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the intelligence community, director of Central Intelligence, the CIA, etc. Tell me what will work. Will this work? And the answer has repeatedly been no.
Margaret Brennan, please stand by there in California. Frederick Hoff joins us right now from Washington, director of the Middle East Center at the Atlantic Council, specializes in Syria, worked on Syria-related issues in the State Department from 2009 until into 2012. In 2012, he had the rank of ambassador conferred by President Obama in connection with work as special advisor for transition in Syria. He's also served as an advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton during his time, of course, at the State Department. Frederick Hoff, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be with you.
You have said that President Obama is bequeathing his successor a humanitarian abomination and a geopolitical catastrophe in Syria. You're pretty strongly on board with these dissenting diplomats.
Yes, I think they're on the right track. They've identified not only a humanitarian disaster but a real political catastrophe, and they're asking the president, I think, in a very respectful way, to take another look at it.
But Joe Biden, you heard him saying right there, they've asked everybody, the military, the Pentagon, the intelligence community, the CIA, what will work? Will this work? And Biden says the answer is no. And he seems to be talking about exactly what they're calling for, U.S. military strikes.
I think what's necessary here, Tom, is for the president to make a very positive assertion to his Secretary of Defense to the effect of, look, we can't protect everybody everywhere. But I need some options. I need to look at some alternatives here. How can we complicate the ability of Bashar al-Assad to commit mass murder? Because without that complication, John Kerry is left in the situation he's in right now, basically clinging to the lapels of his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, imploring him to please stop Assad from doing his worst. I think if there's a clear statement of the commander-in-chief's intent that the Pentagon will come up with options, it could be one of the options mentioned by these 51. It could be something else. This is up to the professionals. But what it requires in the first instance is an assertion by the commander-in-chief that enough is enough.
If there's something real in that glove and it's not just empty, what I'm reading here in their letter and the interpretation of it would be U.S. offshore strikes aimed at Assad's artillery and air force.
That may well be one of the answers produced by military professionals. But again, I think what's important here, Tom, the real center of gravity is a strong statement of the commander-in-chief's intent to his Secretary of Defense. It's only when that's received that the Pentagon, I think, would do a really, really serious job of coming up with options for the president to review, all of which would surely involve some measure of risk. There is absolutely nothing in this business that's risk-free. But the beginning of success in all of this, I think, is a real assertion by the president that he wants to stop this business.
Margaret Brennan, the White House asserts that they've asked the Pentagon, should we do this? And the Pentagon has said no, that he's already gone and asked, and the answers come back negative.
Well, it's not clear, actually, when the White House is saying that there's no military solution, exactly which of the many options they are directly referring to, because the only one you really hear them take down is the idea of invasion, which no one seems to be advocating. They also seem to say, look, we're not going to, quote-unquote, take out Assad because we don't know what happens the next day. That's a different premise than saying change Assad's calculus by making him feel some pressure. There are various forms of limited military action, as you point out, one of the many options there could be. So it's not clear. None of us are in that classified setting to go through what everyone has put on the table so far. But what some have called for is what I think Ambassador Hoff was gesturing to as well, that you can lift a chilling effect, that you can say, show me more options, tell me what is possible, instead of saying, I don't want to take military action, tell me, what the worst case and best case scenarios are. See what is possible, because as Biden said today in this interview, the U.S. is more than capable of carrying out any of these challenges, even with the presence of the Russian Air Force in Syria. You can take some military action of some fashion, but that has to be received, asked for by the president, and then played out to see what works.
Margaret Brennan and Frederick Hoff, please stand by. David Sanger with the New York Times, who put that question to John Kerry in Vienna, joins us in just a moment. I want to get a couple of our callers in here, if I may. Tom in Des Moines, Iowa. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to associate myself, excuse me, with the comments of the last two people you've been talking to. Assad is an institutionalized terrorist. Until we call him that, we're not going to be able to deal with him effectively. The New Yorker has the article called The Assad Files earlier this year that reveals that he is an institutionalized terrorist. And if we deal with him as such a person, then we can come up with the military pressure on him that will get him out of power. He is very vulnerable. We should have done something about this back in 2011, but nothing has been done. The no-fly zone would have been the perfect solution to this, I think, but it was shot down by all the diplomats.
Tom, we did it. We went into Libya after Gaddafi. You see how that turns out? It's a mess. Is this different?
It's a lot different. I mean, it's similar, but it's different. You know, Libya could have turned out differently, and Syria could have turned out differently. There is no easy solution right now.
That's for sure.
Hillary Clinton is talking about a no-fly zone, and that's the most intelligent comment I've heard from any of the presidential candidates.
Tom, let me hold that one right there and get one more. Thank you, Tom. Trip in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I have a question. So I believe it was 2013 when the commander-in-chief, in fact, did say enough is enough. He was beating the war drum. He went live in front of the country and asked Congress for an authorization to strike Assad. And so we understand what's changed.
Around the use of gas by Assad.
Mm-hmm. Correct, yeah. We have evidence, of course, that he was committing genocide against his people.
Yep.
So my question is, what has changed here in the United States politically? We understand, of course, the escalation of ISIS and the changing landscape over there. But I want to know why the president's reaction to it seems to be inversely related to the escalation over there. And how he has somehow turned down his temper while ISIS has turned up, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so, we got to. I mean, to be fair, there's plenty going on in terms of U.S. military action focused on ISIS. But on Assad, no. Frederick Hoff, you write that you've got a dysfunctional White House policy. You're pretty tough. You call it morally vacuous and politically bankrupt. It doesn't get much stronger than that. How do you interpret the president's stance?
Yes, I do believe it's politically bankrupt, and I think the bankruptcy can really be found in the relationship between Assad and ISIS. Look, the president of the United States quite properly has said that his objective is to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. That is a fine objective. The problem he faces is he's divided the Syrian situation artificially into two pieces. One piece is Assad, the other piece is ISIS. We're going after ISIS with airstrikes, with a Kurdish militia. Assad is free to conduct mass homicide, and as he does so, he produces recruits for ISIS in Syria and around the world. So this is the essence of dysfunction in Syria. And of course, we have a humanitarian abomination that really does have political consequences for all of Syria's neighbors, you know, allies, friends of the United States, and Western Europe, where the politics of the Western alliance are really being roiled by all of this to the benefit of Russia, I might add.
David Sanger is with us right now from Washington, national security correspondent for The New York Times. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
We see the sort of hell on wheels in Syria, 400,000 dead, mass suffering, deep unsettling of Europe and allies there by the refugee flow, all kinds of chaos on the scene in ISIS, which has made advances, may have lost some recently. With all that, how do you interpret the Obama administration's deep resistance to going after Assad, even after the threats, even with John Kerry out front saying it's dangerous for them to presume otherwise, but nothing's happened? Why the deep reluctance, even in the face now of this, what's been revealed by your paper, dissent cable?
Well, you have to sort of sort out what you mean when you say the Obama administration. This dissent cable brave as it was, as Margaret described, and motivated, I think, by all of the analysis that Fred's just given you, was written by people who know that the Secretary of State is fundamentally in agreement with them.
And not with the White House, but with them.
No,
those
with
saying,
them.
Let's hit
with
out.
Them. Mm-hmm. And this is what Secretary Kerry has been arguing privately for some time. And when I asked him the plan B question at that news conference that you played the segment of, I knew, and he knew, that he had submitted, among others, he was not the only one, plan B options to President Obama months ago that had sat basically not acted on. And that's what Vice President Biden was referring to obliquely on the Charlie Rose segment that you played, where he said that they've looked at these options. And I think they have looked at these options. So this dissent cable, while written to Secretary Kerry, was actually intended for President Obama. And I'm pretty well convinced that it was leaked so quickly because they wanted to make sure that President Obama was the one who read it and read it, you know, in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal,
everywhere.
And elsewhere. So that was the intended audience, and that's why I think you've seen that Secretary Kerry has not sounded exactly upset that it got out. Now, that said, when you read the cable, the military options that they lay out are relatively simplistic, and I think the military would say unsophisticated. And that's not to surprising. If you had a memo from the generals about what the diplomatic strategy would be, it would probably read the same way. Okay, so it's not. It doesn't really help the situation that much to say back up Secretary Kerry with military pressure. The question is what kind. Now, President Obama could have done some things months ago, years ago, that would have made a difference, I think. One of them is if he had cratered the runways that Assad's Air Force uses, those planes that drop the barrel bombs wouldn't be taking off. So there were other options, but President Obama takes the view that we went into Iraq and Afghanistan full force, 180,000 troops at one point combined between the two, maybe more, and we got what we got. We went into Libya light, and you saw the mess, as you described before.
Yep, yep.
And so he's not at all persuaded that the plan after you have attacked Assad's forces is there. Who would occupy it? How would you keep ISIS from going in and taking Damascus? Would you simply turn Syria into more of a nightmare?
Fred Hoff, you are in favor of doing something here. Would you just turn it into a bigger mess with that action?
I don't think so. I think if the I think if the focus is rigidly on civilian protection as opposed to a military campaign of regime change, I think this is what the 51 signers are looking for. They understand full well that as long as Syrian civilians are on the bullseye, and they are indeed on the bullseye every single day, there cannot be a sustainable diplomatic process.
How do you crater Assad's runways, take out his artillery, take out his air force without raising his vulnerability to regime change?
Certainly it raises his vulnerability, but it doesn't mean that the Syrian army has disappeared. And I think the way that our military would go about this would be a series of limited strikes, a pause. Let's see if this is enough to get people to the table for serious negotiations.
Tom, it's we can come back to it
right
at the end,
break.
But there's some interesting analysis of Tom's of that look.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the story of the 51 State Department officials who came out last week for U.S. military action in Syria. A more muscular U.S. posture there to get Bashar al-Assad to a negotiating table. They scarcely come near. Looking at the dissent channel on Obama foreign policy here, the call for more teeth. Margaret Brennan is with us, covers the State Department for CBS News. Frederick Hoff is here. He was in the State Department from 2009 to 2012, right in the middle of Syria issues there. David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times, is here, and you can join us as well. Would you have signed this letter, the so-called dissent cable, or are you standing with the Obama doctrine here? This morning, Vice President Joe Biden talked with CBS This Morning, said the U.S. should not use force unless it meets certain basic criteria.
Is it in the national security interest of the United States? Are our interests directly threatened, number one, or our allies? Number two, can we use it efficaciously? Will it work? And number three, can it be sustained?
But my guest Fred Hoff says you have coming just about to be bequeathed to a successor, a humanitarian abomination and a geopolitical catastrophe in Syria. A few callers right here. Bill in Lexington, Kentucky. Bill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate the good job, too. I think that President Obama is the adult in the room. I believe that, looking back at Libya, looking at Iraq, for that matter, going back to 1953, all of our foreign policy has gone toward destabilizing the Middle East. And when we see such horrific suffering, if we think that this suffering is going to stop, if we intervene now militarily, we are wrong. I mean, it can only, I think what we'll see is an increase in suffering, both here at home and abroad.
Bill, how, I mean, already 400,000 dead, and we've seen the millions displaced and the floods coming into Europe and Jordan and the people drowning trying to get to Greece.
Yes, that's right. And look at Iraq.
But that's already, under the Obama policy, Bill.
Yes, exactly. But what did Obama inherit? When you think of Bush Cheney, I mean, President Obama has been cleaning up their mess, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy. And God love him for it. It's a horrible thing to watch. And we need to do everything in our power from a humanitarian point of view, even to the point of making reparations for some of these countries that we've invaded and destabilized and caused, such tremendous suffering.
Bill, we've got it. You see the president as the adult in the room here, and let me hold that thought and get one more, and we'll come to it. Sheila in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sheila, you're on.
I would echo what that gentleman just said. I think that we have erred in looking at military responses rather than seeking out nonviolent ways of dealing with the situation. There's actually a bill in the Senate, which I don't think is going anywhere, talking about the fact that we need more training in nonviolent resistance. But I really called because of the request for a no-fly zone. Former Secretary of Defense Bill Gates said that a no-fly zone was almost an immediate declaration of war with Russia. And we've discussed before, you've discussed on your program, mm-hmm. how dangerous a no-fly zone could be if one of our planes, if we hit a Russian plane. We are in a very, very, that is a very difficult situation to add any more military force to ratchet that up, is asking for a war against countries that do, and you spelled out the interests of Russia. It's really close to Russia. It's on its southern border.
Yeah, Sheila, we've got it. Let me pick that one up as well, and I'll take them both, and I thank you for your call. Fred Hoff, first to you. Our Lexington caller says President Obama is the adult in the room with his restraint here and applauds him for it. You call Obama's policy morally vacuous and politically bankrupt.
Yes. Well, look, no doubt it's not easy to be president of the United States. No doubt that all of these decisions are very, very difficult, and there are risks associated with all of them, and there are no silver bullets for Syria.
But what are our callers missing? I mean, Sheila says you're going to put us at war with Russia. Our Lexington, Kentucky caller says, there's no good end to these things, kind of what Joe Biden is saying this morning.
I think what would have been useful for the vice president to cite were the president's words when he in December 2009, when he delivered his Nobel Peace lecture. And I quote, I believe that force can be justified on humanitarian grounds, as it was in the Balkans or in other places that have been scarred by war, unquote. What we're talking about here is civilian protection more than anything else. Nobody wants to reach to force for the first option. All options have to be exhausted. But what we are seeing is an absolute determination on the part of the Assad regime to commit mass homicide, to continue with a policy of collective punishment. The humanitarian effects are grotesque, and the political effects on our objectives, on Syria's neighbors, on our allies in Europe are very, very serious indeed.
Tom, just to build on Fred's point here, the humanitarian argument that President Obama laid out in the Nobel speech, he then reiterated when the U.S. Took the air action in Libya, which was certainly a case where, as your earlier caller indicated, Bob Gates had certainly said we have no national interests. And you heard Vice President Biden try to lay out the national interest argument here. The fact of the matter is that two things have changed in Syria. The humanitarian risk has grown much greater than it ever was in Libya. We took action in Libya to protect maybe 10,000 people in Benghazi at the time, and there are nearly 500,000 dead already in Syria. The second is that the national interest, which seemed remote in Syria at the beginning of the conflict, seems greater now that you have a migrant crisis that is threatening to destabilize Europe. And so those are the two changed factors. The problem is that while the United States waited on these issues, Russia did enter the war. And that did make it much riskier, as your last caller indicated. Mm-hmm. And that changes the calculus and in some ways has further paralyzed the U.S. You'll remember that President Obama said to the Russians, good luck with that. Well, the Russians did manage to tilt the playing field back toward Assad.
Margaret Brennan, you cover the State Department. Do you read here diplomats who are supposed to get the work done saying that the Obama doctrine, if you will, of deep reluctance to intervene militarily has paralyzed their capacity to do their work, to find any kind of settlement here in this case?
Well, at a certain point, the question has to be asked, you know, if you don't change the policy to reflect the changing facts on the ground, can you get to an effective outcome, specifically the one that you've said is your goal, which is a negotiated political settlement? And right now, there are those who take a step back, and as Fred described, you look at the masses, the thousands of refugees spilling into Europe and destabilizing, some would argue, our allies, particularly Jordan and the camps in Lebanon, virtually exploding with refugees flowing across their border. You have this worry about destabilization to the region. You now have nearly 500,000 dead in Syria. At what point do you say it's damaging to America's credibility around the world if we say that the strategy is working, and if we say that we're going to try and continue to sit down at a negotiating table that the UN envoy right now says is not working?
It looks farcical.
Well, that's the argument that diplomats who are critical of the policy are making. It's not an argument I'm making. But big picture, take a step back, say, look, this is actually going to hurt us because we can't continue to sit down at a negotiating table knowing that on the ground the cessation of hostilities is not being abided by and that virtually every deadline that's set is blown through or ignored and defied by the Assad regime, including the delivery of food and medicine. So that's the concern when you look at the diplomatic portion of it as well. And you had the UN envoy say just today, we can't hold peace talks right now. Ask me next month. Maybe then I can see a light at the end of the tunnel. So when you have the UN envoy saying the situation's not ripe, look at the merits and look at the question of what's happening on the ground on the diplomatic piece here. And so at a minimum, there's a call for a policy review. Even if, you know, the prescription to be written isn't military force, it certainly calls for revisiting the premise of how to reach your goal of a political solution.
But David's saying if the Tomahawk missiles are unloosed from U.S. Naval vessels in the Mediterranean, let's say, and you hit Assad's air force, you hit his runways, you go after his artillery, If you open up the possibility for him to actually fall, do you end up with something else here? I mean, I haven't seen anything that looks like an opposition that could come in and run this country. Do you have a recipe for another complete free fire zone here, complete sort of meltdown and mayhem through the whole country if Assad wobbles or even falls?
Tom, you've just given voice to President Obama's argument back to his advisors, which is, do we know how to do tomahawks? Yeah. Do we know how to go retake a city? Absolutely. We're really good at that. What we're not good at is what happens next. And the president then says, so let's say we're going to do a humanitarian protection of the civilians, as Fred here has just made the case for. At some point, you have to do that on the ground. And then the question is, who does that? And unlike in the Libya case, you haven't seen the Arab League step up and say, yeah, we'll volunteer forces for that. You haven't seen a convincing plan. And President Obama doesn't want to be the one to put U.S. forces in the way to protect that civilian population, even in a no-fly zone, from being run over by Assad's forces on the ground. So he's thinking two or three steps out on the chessboard, which, you know, to some is extremely gratifying, and to others is a formula for paralysis. And I think what you've seen in the dissent memo is people saying, let's try the next step of more military pressure first and see if it brings Assad to the table. The difficulty is you only have 6 months left. And if you're Assad and you're looking at John Kerry and Barack Obama, you're saying their leverage diminishes every day.
So why move? Let's go to Columbia, Missouri, and Willie. Willie, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I strongly support President Obama's reluctance to increase our military force, to increase military pressure. The last 15 years has illustrated quite well that military solutions are just making the problem worse. And if it had the effect that the people in favor of this think it will, that still leaves us at a point where we're in a situation where there could be, it could devolve into a worse situation.
Willie, we've got it. There's a no thank you out of Columbia, Missouri, and I appreciate that, Willie. I want to take it to Margaret Brennan, but one more call first. Jefferson in Austin, Texas. Jefferson, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to take it back to the discussion around Russia. I'd be curious to know from the guests what they think in Putin's mind and what's happening in the halls of the Kremlin. I think it's quite difficult to extricate the policies with Assad from those in our relationship with Russia and that regime, particularly when you consider the military situation in the Ukraine and Crimea, even potential political destabilization in places like Kosovo and their policy in Chechnya. So just be curious to know, I think in a broader sense, what's in Putin's mind and how critical is that relationship for Kerry?
Let me take that to Margaret Brennan. I appreciate your call, Jefferson. Margaret, the Russia front, how do you see the State Department, the White House reading Russia here? And interesting, you know, a lot of our callers are saying we haven't seen the evidence that intervention works. No, thank you.
Well, it's interesting because there was a lot of frustration over at the Pentagon last week when Russia went in with their Air Force and attacked U.S.-trained rebels in an area that I've had a number of U.S. officials say they had not seen extremists like the Nusra Front intermingling with forces, which in the past has been Russia's excuse saying, look, we're trying to hit the bad guys. Yeah. They got a little too close to your guys.
So it's kind of right in our face last week.
It was seen as very egregious and some argued deliberate. So in some ways, you already do have that direct conflict. You know, U.S. taxpayers are paying money to have some training and equipping to happen and to have U.S. advisors on the ground to battle ISIS, and then you have Russia going in and bombing them from the sky. And that was raised through diplomatic channels and at the Pentagon as well. So you already have this bubbling up. As to get into Putin's mind, I can't tell you the exact calculus. The White House says, look, eventually it's going to cost him, certainly financially, if not, you know, militarily down the line, to have committed Russian forces. But at the moment, in terms of leverage, in terms of influence in the region, Russia has increased its position. And in fact, as Fredhoff described it, you know, John Kerry's leverage at the negotiating table has been to push the Russians and say, please rein in your client in Damascus and get him to allow in food and medicine. Get him to stop bombing these areas.
Not happening.
And so the U.S. has relied in many ways on Russia at the negotiating table because the U.S. doesn't have that leverage. And so it's very frustrating for many diplomats.
Fredhoff, we've just got half a minute here, but isn't the leverage out there already that Hillary Clinton has a tougher line than Barack Obama? Donald Trump, who knows, but he's talked occasionally very tough. I mean, shouldn't Assad see a tougher line coming over the horizon with the November elections in any case and maybe try to cut his deal with this administration?
Well, Tom, precisely. If I were advising Vladimir Putin, I'd say make the deal with this administration and don't wait. But my concern is, as we fail to respond to these attacks and Russian air attacks on American units, we run the risk of Russia drawing the wrong conclusion about American resolve and maybe pushing elsewhere, such as in the Ukraine or the Baltics.
David Singer, how many more months does the Obama doctrine stand?
Well, it stands for six more months. What's interesting is you've had Hillary Clinton take the more hawkish view and say that she would call for a no-fly zone. Don't know if that's going to be possible by the time a new president takes over. And we haven't heard from Donald Trump what his strategy would be, which is in and of itself fascinating since this is one of the most pressing foreign policy issues on the agenda.
There. David Sanger with the New York Times, Fred Hoff with the Atlantic Council, Margaret Brennan with CBS. Our deep thanks to all three of you for taking us in here today. Thank you so much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.